This broadcast of Irish Radio Hour from Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, is paid for by Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to This Irish American Life. Coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan-Gray, and I am your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Glucksman Ireland House is New York University's Centre for the Study of Ireland and the Irish Diaspora. It was founded in 1993 by Loretta Brennan Glucksman and her late husband, Lewis L. Glucksman. We teach, research, archive, provide public programs, and generally educate our community on the Irish experience at home and abroad. We come to you every week from our home on Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. On this week's This Irish American Life, I am thrilled to share with you an interview I had the pleasure of conducting recently with the internationally acclaimed Indian-born British-American novelist and essayist Salman Rushdie. Salman is on faculty at NYU in the journalism school, in fact, and he agreed to take part in a course we offered this academic year called Big Ideas Identity. Well, Big Ideas is the theme of these short courses, and the sub-theme for this Big Ideas course was the topic of identity. And Salman agreed to discuss plural identity, the multiplicities of identities, etc., etc. And in that context, I interviewed him about this theme. It's very, very interesting to interrogate or have a chance to talk to him about his background. He's born in Mumbai at a momentous time in Indian history. Indeed, as a historian of Irish history, very interesting parallels and kind of an ease with which one might discuss colonial, post-colonial India in the context of the Irish experience. As it so happens, Salman's most recent book has just been published, is just actually published. I think the official publication date is May 27th. We didn't discuss that new book, actually, but you'll hear lots more about that. Indeed, the reviews have started to come in. And as I said, our brief in that conversation was the topic of identity, and he took on the sub-theme of a plural identity. One of the great richnesses of working at NYU is the opportunity to encounter people of the stature of Mr. Rushdie, and our faculty and especially our students are really enriched by having people of Salman's stature and background and reach within access. And I have to say, it was a pleasure of my academic year in the context of a rather trying year in general for everyone, and of course as an educator, all that came with migrating to online, etc., etc. The opportunity to encounter Salman and indeed to enjoy that experience so much. And I suppose if you listen to this program regularly, you will gather that I like to interview people. It's probably my most... I love researching too, in using traditional methods, but I really, really enjoy the dynamic of an interview, and it was a real pleasure to have this opportunity. I was thinking about interviews a little bit during the week as well in the context of the 80th birthday of Bob Dylan. That got a lot of coverage for obvious reasons. Mr. Dylan has been a real, what would you say, change agent, or someone who has influenced so much in terms of music on an international level. And I was really pleasantly, not so much surprised, but pleased to hear how much the Clancy brothers, Liam and Tom and everyone, how much recognition they got in the context of influencing the young Bob Dylan. I think his His name was Bob Zimmerman as his real name, his birth name at the time. But I enjoyed the references to the Clancys in the context of their immense influence on Irish America and Irish identity formation in the United States in the 1960s in particular. And it was kind of fun to hear the invoking of the Clancy brothers. And I was thinking that in particular in the context of the interview I had the pleasure of undertaking with the late Liam Clancy. I was thinking of Liam Clancy in particular. I had the opportunity and honour of interviewing him in 2009, I believe it was, when Liam died. I interviewed him actually. I think he died in the December, and I had the pleasure of interviewing him in the, like, March. It was his last trip to the United States. Anyway, I know Liam Clancy was looking down, getting a giggle at the reach of what they did and their relationship to the iconic Bob Dylan. Anyway, enough about my rambling on here, and let me hand over, as this was our final public program in our spring event series and of the academic year 2020-21, a year we won't forget. And what a nicer way to finish it out than to share with you the conversation that I thoroughly enjoyed with Salman Rushdie, and I had done a warm-up interview with him in advance, and it was a real honour. So, as I said, I'm handing over now to myself in conversation with internationally acclaimed writer and essayist Salman Rushdie in the context of a course which was called Big Ideas, Identity, and our subtopic for the conversation was Plural Identity. Thanks for tuning into This Irish American Life, folks, to me, Miriam Nighan Gray, in conversation with Salman Rushdie.
Hello, welcome. I'm so delighted to have Salman Rushdie here with me today. Thank you so much, Salman, for agreeing to participate in this exciting course for this semester on big ideas. And the big idea for this course is identity. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being here. It's a real honour for me. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray. I'm attached to the Centre for Irish Studies at NYU. And I guess to kick off the interview today, Salman, you were born and raised in India. And I guess one of the themes that I'd like to unpack a little bit with you today is that sense of contingency in identity and how identity is framed by geography and history and all these things. Can you start us off by telling us a little bit about the Bombay, now Mumbai, of your youth?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was born at a very interesting moment in Indian history, which was right around the time of the independence of India and the end of the British Empire. I mean, I'm actually 8 weeks to the day after I was born, the British Empire came to an end. So I'm of that generation, which was the first generation of free Indian people, not colonialized, not under the imperial yoke, to be born for over 200 years, you know, and so that's always has interested me, because of course one of the things about colonialism is that it doesn't disappear on the day that the colonialists disappear. You know, a kind of legacy of it remains, and that can take quite a long time to change. I mean, I think, for example, one of the reasons why I'm speaking to you in English is that, although my mother tongue was Urdu, is that in my childhood, the good schools in Bombay were still all English language schools, which were left behind by the British. So I went to something called the Cathedral School, which, you know, which speaks for itself, really. And I grew up at bilingually. And beyond that, there was also the question of being born at a moment of great violence between the newly formed countries of India and Pakistan, the so-called partition massacres, when nobody knows exactly how many people died, but I mean, a good guess would be upwards of 1 million people were Hindu people murdered by Muslim people and Muslims murdered by Hindus at the frontier and at or near the frontier. And my parents, I mean, my family background is Muslim, is Kashmiri Muslim. And my parents were not particularly religious people and chose not to go to the newly formed state of Pakistan because they essentially didn't want to live in a religious state, you know, and they felt, to put it simply, they felt more Indian than Muslim, you know, but at the same time, they were very worried about the mounting violence. And when they first got married, they were living in the capital city of Delhi. And they felt, rightly, that Delhi was going to be a dangerous place to be. So they migrated internally from Delhi to what was then called Bombay, because they felt that it would be much calmer there. And as it happens, that is true. There was almost no violence in Bombay, and there was a lot of violence in Delhi. So they did this move just before I was born. I mean, like the year before I was born. And so I was born and raised in this great city, maybe the most cosmopolitan metropolis in India, to a Muslim family, a non-practicing Muslim family in a Hindu majority country. And so in a sort of minority. But the thing about that period in which I was growing up, like the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s in India, is that there really was a kind of Indian secularism that transcended religious sectarianism. And you could be Indian in a way where you felt that all the traditions belonged to you. You know, so me, for example, growing up in my immediate neighborhood, the kids I played with, the families that my parents knew, were of every conceivable religious disposition. Hindu, Muslim, Christian, Sikh, Jain, Buddhist. They were Europeans, Americans, as well as Indians living there. And so I grew up in this very cosmopolitan little world. You know, and felt that I had access to, you know, a Parsi festival, a Hindu festival, as much as they would have access to, you know, a Muslim festival like Eid, for example. And that really has changed in India, you know, because religious sectarianism has returned with a vengeance, and the communities are much more divided from each other. Now your identity is very often, you're obliged to frame it in religious terms. And even if you choose not to, that is done for you, you know, by other people. So Muslims like my parents, who were secularized, non-practicing, would now be certainly defined by the majority culture, by their religion. You know, and so that's a big difference. I mean, I grew up in this more tolerant world, I guess.
But Salman, can I just ask you, in that Bombay as you grew up, there still existed the, you know, because what a lot of non-Indian people associate with India is the caste system, and that would have coexisted within that environment as well.
The caste system was certainly there then and still is there now. But in that sense, being from a Muslim family background, I was excused that because the caste system doesn't happen in the Muslim tradition. That's a particularly Hindu thing. Casteism, I think, is one of the really besetting problems of India because it's one of the things that limits social mobility and in a way prevents the society from becoming fully a modern society. It's still very powerful.
You describe very well there the hangover or the aftermath of British influence in India as you grew up as a young child. But at a certain point in time, I believe you opt yourself to go and study in England. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, when I was, I guess I was 13 and about to arrive at the moment of high school, of secondary school, you know, and my father asked me if I would be interested to go to school in England, which it, the question itself is an indication of the remnants of respect for the British educational system, things like that. You know, now that question might not be asked, but it was, and I had been, I guess, sufficiently influenced by English culture growing up that I said yes, and I was not bullied to go. You know, I mean, my mother actively did not want me to go. And my father said, it's your decision and you have to pass the exam. And if you get in, if you pass the exam, would you go? And something in me said, yes, I would go. I don't know whether that's some spirit of adventure or just the fact that I had read a lot of English children's books and, you know, and felt in some way attached to that culture, even though I'd never set foot in the country. It is one of the interesting things about the end of British Empire in India, is that although people were very hostile, my parents' generation and the generation before them were very hostile to the idea of the British Empire, that hostility didn't really extend to individual English people. You know, and people, there was a sort of separation made, rather kind of sophisticated, generous sophistication, separation made between the individuals and the system. So that then and now, you know, English people going to India don't really face hostility.
So would you say that that was your first major encounter or a time in your life where you had to be very, you were forced into being reflective about sensibilities of identity?
Yes, because when I came to England to boarding school, I felt that this was, I was coming to a culture that I knew quite a lot about, you know, and I spoke the language fluently and etc. But what I discovered very quickly at this boarding school, the rugby school, where the game of rugby football was invented. And I discovered essentially racial prejudice for the first time in my life. I discovered what it was like to be somebody else's other, you know, and I was deeply shocked. I mean, you could even say traumatized by a direct experience of, you know, coming into my little study and discovering that somebody had torn up my work, or had written a racist slogan on the wall. You know, I mean, things like that were happening. They stopped happening as I grew older. I mean, that's to say, by the time I was 18 and leaving the school, that wasn't happening really anymore. But the first years were quite tough in that regard. And I learned then more or less everything I now know about how racism works. You know, I think that young boy at the boarding school in some ways was, you know, he was my younger self came from a conservative Indian family and was in a conservative English environment and was the product of that. It was much later when I was at university that I began to develop, you know, more progressive, let's say, political and social ideas. But the one thing that I came out of school with was this really sophisticated knowledge about racism, and not being like those people. Mm-hmm. And actually not wanting to be, you know, when I left school, I had already got a place at Cambridge University, in the same college, King's College, that my father had gone to. And I didn't want to go. And I said to my parents, look, I don't want to go back there. Why didn't I just go to university here? There's perfectly good universities here. My father in particular was very keen that I should go to his old college and persuaded me. And I'm actually very glad that he did, because that return to a different kind of England was quite healing. Because what I found at university was, first of all, a much more international world. a world which was not bigoted in the way that some of the boys had been at boarding school. I should say about boarding school that when I talk about racism, I'm not talking about the faculty. The teaching, I felt, was of a very high standard. I'm talking about other boys being nasty in the way that boys can be. At university, I had a completely different experience, you know, and I came out of that understanding, I mean, I think a good lesson to learn, which is that every country is many countries, you know, and some of those countries you can feel comfortable in, and other versions of that country you would feel very uncomfortable in. And I think that's true about the United States now, you know.
So you remained then in the UK for quite a long period of time then, Salman?
Yeah, because by the time I left, I wanted to be a writer, and in those days, it was very hard to lead a literary life in India, you know, just to pay for yourself, you know. And again, that's very much changed. And I think the 21-year-old version of me graduating now might well feel it was fine to go back to India and try to be a writer there, because there are now, there's ways of employment, there's magazines, there's, you know, there's all ways in which you can earn a living and begin a literary life. And not just earning a living, there are people amongst whom you can be bouncing ideas off, showing your work to, and learning, you know, how to do it. So in those days that didn't exist. You either had to be really rich, or you had to live with your parents, or you had to get a different job and write in your spare time. Mm-hmm. And I made the choice to stay in England and try and do it there.
And is there a distinct moment for you when, you know, I'm conscious, you know, the students who are watching this interview today are thinking about what they want to do next in life and what the choices they've made in terms of their majors and stuff like this. How early on for you, Salman, was the identification as a writer or self-identifying in that way or embracing that, you know, a little bit unorthodox kind of trajectory, perhaps, from your family background?
My parents were not in favor of it. My father said, "What will I tell my friends when I told them I wanted to be a writer?" But actually, once they understood that I was really serious about it, they were supportive of it, I have to say.
I hope he lived to see your success.
He did, actually. He lived to see his friends calling him and congratulating him, so he didn't have to say anything to his friends. They said it to him.
Wonderful.
But I had that desire from quite an early age, I think. But I mean, the thing is, to say as a young person, I want to be a writer, it's sort of meaningless, because you don't know what it is to be a writer. You don't know what it takes to be a writer. And I think what I meant by it was that I loved the world of books. I loved reading. I loved inhabiting the world of books. And so I began to think that I'd like to try to be a part of that. You know, so more or less immediately after leaving university, that's what I tried to do. It took me a long time to have any kind of success.
And the creative side was what you know. You could have opted, for example, to write history books, but
yeah, no, I didn't want to. I definitely knew by the time I left university that I was not an academic, and I didn't want to devote my life to scholarship in that way, you know, because that was not temperamentally who I was. And yeah, the imaginative stuff was always there to begin with. But as I say, there was an awful lot of false starts and many, many years of writing complete garbage before I found my direction.
You've lived in the United States for a considerable period now.
20 years now.
But yeah, so, I think you mentioned to me before you've kind of equal amounts of time roughly now between India and the UK and the United States.
Yeah.
How, I guess maybe from an American perspective, how have your views of your own identity or conceptions of identity more general in the American context changed over time?
Well, as I say, the thing is that in all these three societies, the subject, the question of, or questions of identity have become more and more central, I think. But they're not the same questions in the three places. You know, so in India, the, as we were saying earlier, the identity really revolves around the question of religious identity. And within Hindu religion, the question of caste identity. And really, whoever you are, wherever you are in India, of whatever social class, etc., that question is at the heart of the discussion. And it used to be the case that you could identify as a much more secular individual, and I think there still are plenty of people in India who feel like that. But the dynamic of the culture under the present administration and so on has really shifted towards an emphasis on religious sectarianism, and therefore the risk of growing conflict. You know, in the UK, in England, it really has, identity questions have really nothing to do with religion at all. They, in fact, if you try to raise the subject of religion, people look at you strangely. So, in England, it has more to do with the fact that I think the British have never fully worked through what it was to be an imperialist culture, and what it is to have ceased to be that. You know, what it was to be the most powerful nation in the world, and what it now is to have become, you know, a relatively small island off the shore of Europe. And so that question of what is it to be British, and in particular, what is it to be English? Because I think that the Celtic cultures, the Scots and the Welsh and the Irish, have a clearer sense of a kind of national identity. Englishness is a question mark. And I think, for example, one of the reasons for the success of the Brexit project was that the Brexiteers sold a kind of mythology of Englishness, of the kind of glory days of, you know, I don't know, King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, you know, good old England, oldie Englandy, you know, which we could have back if only there weren't all these inconvenient foreigners around. And of course that polemic completely excluded the history of the country as a colonial power. You know, that was never mentioned as a source of wealth or comfort. But it appealed to people, you know, and split the country more or less down the middle. I mean, more or less 50-50, you know, or 51-49. I mean, very close. And so there in England, the identity revolves around this question about national identity, about which there's a lot of confusion. Crossing the ocean and coming to America, first of all, you realize immediately that religion is more important here than it is there. You know, and in a way, this is quite a religious country, you know, left or right. I mean, difficult to be elected dog catcher in the United States if you don't talk about going to church every Sunday. You know, so that's a big difference. And beyond that, there's this is such a huge country. So there are questions of regional identity, which are very powerful for people. I think, you know, if you come from the deep South, you feel very much a person of the South, you know, and the West Coast is not like the East Coast, you know, so on. And then there are two issues that have become colossally important. Well, one always has been, which is the issue of race. And that's clearly exploded into a kind of national debate right now. I mean, maybe a long overdue debate, but here it is. I think if you were to talk to African Americans, they would say that the things that people now protest about have always been happening, you know, but now they seem to have reached a kind of tipping point where it's in a kind of wider, broader national consciousness, that subject. And the other thing that's become very significant in recent years here is gender identity. And that's one of the things where I found myself connecting back to Indian experience. because growing up in Bombay, I, from an early age, I was familiar with a quite significant transsexual community there, the so-called Hijra community, and knew something about the difficulties they faced and the prejudices they faced. And more recently, I mean, as a writer, I did go back and investigate that and spend substantial amount of time with members of that community to learn about their lives. And I met, I mean, quite a cross-section. I mean, some of them were very, kind of very wounded individuals, you know, people who had been rejected by their family because of their gender choice and so on. From that end of the spectrum there, to the other end, where there were people who were very confident and kind of activist and wanting to be involved in the politics of the community and improving the condition of the community and so on. So the whole spectrum. But the one thing I found that they all agreed on without any exceptions was that they did not see themselves as male or female. They did not see themselves as, you know, as men who had become women. They saw themselves as a third gender, mm-hmm. and insisted that that was how they should be treated, that it was a third principle. And I then was looking into the history of this thing and discovered that way back in the ancient times of Hindu mythology, there are quite a lot of precursors to that idea. You know, there are gods who are bi-gendered. You know, there's one actually in Bombay, just off the coast of Bombay. There's an island called Elephanta, in which there are ancient cave carvings, and one of those cave carvings is of this double-sexed god called Ardhanarishwara. Ardha means half, Nari means woman, Ishwara means god. So the half-woman god, where the statue is literally, stone statue is literally carved male on one side and female on the other. And so these ideas of gender complexity and fluidity, you know, were there in India from a very long time ago. And
Salman, was that your point there, really, in terms of that's the character D in the Golden House novel, yeah. Right? It was that your kind of point in terms of that characterization in the novel, in terms of saying these conversations about gender identities, et cetera, are not new. There's a much longer history.
Exactly. And even in this country, if you look at the histories of several Native American tribes, they also have a history of having more than two genders described. You know, and so yeah, this is not this didn't just happen. You know, human beings have been thinking about this on and off in many cultures for a long time, and that was very interesting to me. Especially as you say, when I set out to explore the subject in a novel. By having a important character who is thinking about transitioning and who is worried about it, agonized about it, and that became for me these histories became useful to me. But also, I think I had to do some reportage work. I had to, you know, I teach in the journalism school, and I know that sometimes you just have to go and find things out. You know, you can't sit in your room and imagine it completely. And so I did do my research, you know, and because I didn't want to be guilty of getting it clumsily wrong. You know, I wanted to feel that I knew the subject and could write about it with that sympathy and knowledge.
And tell me when it was published, and I'm sure knowing you sought feedback from people who would be important to you in terms of judging that. Yes. Was the feedback positive in that way?
Actually, to my enormous surprise, nobody attacked me. I mean, in these days when, you know, everybody attacks everybody, particularly on social media, it didn't happen. And that made me think, well, either nobody read the book, or maybe I didn't do too badly about getting the character right or credible. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think so. I think in America now, race and gender are the two primary locations, but behind that, I think there's a third question of national identity, which is maybe the biggest of all, which is what is it to be American now? You know, and here there's a enormous rift down the middle of the society. You know, that there's a kind of liberal progressive America, and there's an extremely conservative America, who almost can't recognize each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we see the consequences of that in everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I always feel when I see the red hat inviting us to make America great again, I always want to ask, when was it? When was that? You know, what was the date to which we should now seek to return? You know, was it, for example, when there was slavery? You know, was it when women didn't have the vote? Was it before the civil rights movement? You know, what is that golden age? You know, because one of the things I know about golden age rhetoric is that golden ages don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're invented retrospectively. You know, the good old days.
Mm-hmm.
The good old days weren't particularly good when they were there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, and I think that's, to my mind, one of the things that all these three countries that I've spent my life thinking about are all in some way doing. You know, the American Republican approach is to create this idea of some kind of notional golden age without ever being very specific about it. The British, again, invented this glorious past of England, which could be brought back by leaving Europe. And the Indian Hindu government talks about a golden age of Hinduism before the Muslim invasions. And so in each case, you've got in a way, a kind of fantasy of the past being used to justify actions in the present.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, yeah, and I think the question about American identity is very vexed right now. And I think one of the things I feel is that if you look at the way in which Europeans came to America, in Europe, that was an age of religious persecution, and some people came, the Pilgrim Fathers came here to escape from religious persecution. Whereas what then happened in the 18th century in Europe was a rebellion against religion, you know, characterized by what we call the Enlightenment, which was very influential in shaping the kind of country that the United States became. Many of those ideas became American ideas. So in Europe, you had freedom. Was defined as freedom from religion, you know. Whereas in early America, freedom felt like freedom for religion,
mm-hmm.
you know, to be able to come here and practice your religion free of persecution. And I think that's one of the big differences in the ideas of freedom between these two cultures, Europe and America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Europe, freedom is the opposite of religion, and here it's not.
What advice, Salman, would you give, you know, young scholars emerging today who are particularly interested in topics to do with identity, which of course encompasses such a broad category of disciplines and approaches and things like that, but people in particular, maybe young people who aspire to writing and your, you know, the model that you provided in terms of your career, in terms of your work. What advice would you give young people today?
Well, the thing I most strongly feel is that we live in a moment where we are being encouraged from all sides to define our identity more and more narrowly. You know, we're asked to think of ourselves as like one thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are we gay or straight? Are we black or white? Are we Muslim or Christian? You know, etc. And the problem with that is that when you define your identity in that very narrow way, you create gulfs between yourself and other people, and it makes a kind of common social experience much harder. Whereas actually one of the things that the novel and novelists have always known is that human identity isn't like that. Mm-hmm. Human identity is plural and contradictory and many things at once. You know, the way in which we are with our parents is not the person we are with our children. Mm-hmm. The person that we are with our friends is not the person we are with our employer. Mm-hmm. You know, we can have strong differences from each other in one area, but affinities in other areas. You know, we can have great political differences, but support the same sports team. Mm-hmm. You know, we can support radically different sports teams, but have the same health problems. You know, we can not have the same health problems, but we can have similar views about how to raise children. You know, in other words, we are all many, many selves. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think one of the things we know in the kind of post-Freudian age is that the self is not a simple homogeneous entity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's as Walt Whitman said, you know, we contain multitudes, you know, and those multitudes can be contradictory within ourselves. But what I'm saying is, if we learn that that is who we are, and that's one of the lessons I think the novel teaches us. You know, literature shows people as being many-sided, you know, and that's how you create a deep character. If a character is only one thing, it's two-dimensional and flat and uninteresting. Mm-hmm. For a character in a book to be engaging, it has to be deep and many-sided. And we are like that too.
I think, Salman, would you agree that when you're an immigrant, you have a particular advantage in that way because innately you're almost always comparing in a way with your, even in, you know, I think even over long periods of time, because you've been socialized elsewhere, you have a frame of reference that is different, that is, can be an advantage in that way.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I think, you know, I've been an immigrant most of my life. I mean, from that moment at the age of 13 and a half when I left India for England. First, I'm a kind of double migrant, first from India to England and then from England to America. Mm-hmm. So most of my all of my adult experience is that of seeing the world through the eyes of somebody who's arrived, not, you know, and I think that the question of arrival, you know, it's a very, first of all, it has problems because you feel you don't understand the place, you know, and you have to learn things which other people can take for granted, and maybe people don't like you because they're prejudiced or whatever it may be, but it has that gift of being able to be at once inside and outside, mm-hmm. at once a part of the culture you've come to, and able to take a step back from it and look at it from another perspective. Mm-hmm. And for me as a writer, that's always been, you know, kind of a gift, a helpful thing. And I have written, I mean, the last three novels I've written have all been American novels. They've all been set in America. But in all three, they're very different in manner, but in all three, the country is seen through the eyes of people who have recently arrived. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the kind of, first of all, that's a classic American novel, you know. I mean, one of the great subjects of American life is the question of arrival, because, you know, everyone's an immigrant. Mm-hmm. Except for Native Americans. And so it's a central theme, but it's become richer these days because now immigration comes from everywhere. You know, American immigration traditionally was Eastern European Jewish immigration or Southern European Italian immigration, and then some Hispanic immigration coming up from Latin America. But now, I mean, literally the world is here, you know, and if you walk down the streets of this city, New York, you see people from literally everywhere in the world being local. And I think if just at the level of literature, it's had the most amazingly enriching effect on American literature. Because now you have American writers from South Asia, American writers from the Caribbean or from Africa, not African American, but African who became American. You have Vietnamese writers, you have Korean writers. Literally every culture in the world has now poured itself into American literature and enormously enriched it. So I'm biased on the subject of immigration. It seems to me that its effect is always to enrich a culture and not as the bigotry would have it, to impoverish the culture. Even economically, you know, I mean, our colleague Siketu Mehta at the Journalism School wrote this book last year, This Land is Our Land, in which he very effectively shows how immigrants bring money into a culture rather than take it out. You know, they kind of build the economy rather than becoming a drain on it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's been one of my big subjects. I mean, that's, if you're talking about identity, I very much see my identity as being a migrant. In what is, I think, an age of migration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. That's a great response. It's wonderful to hear your reflections on that. We're coming towards the end of our time. I have one last question, but it's a three-parter. I wanted to ask you when you feel most Indian, most British, and most American or New Yorker, whatever those mean to you.
Well, to take them backwards, New Yorker I feel every day. I've lived here now for over 20 years. And before I lived here, I was coming here a lot. So American is, as I say, this is a huge country. And it's difficult to identify with all of it. But I identify very strongly with New York City. England, when I'm able to be there, you know, I immediately feel a very deep sense of connection there in history, you know. And India is always with me. I mean, I think nothing has shaped my imagination and my creative process more than being from India and of India. And I've never managed to write a novel yet which didn't have an Indian central character. I mean, ever. In 20 books, there are obviously characters from all over the place in the novels, but the central figures, the point of view characters and so on, are always, like me, from South Asia. So I guess that's the fundamental thing as far as identity is concerned.
Well, we've returned in that to your home identity and kind of where we started this interview, Salman. Thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity to interview you today for this wonderful course. I know that our students will find it absolutely enriching, and we look forward to your next book, and thank you again for participating.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to watching the series myself.
Me too. Thank you so much.
Bye now.
Kilkelly, Ireland, 18 and 60, my dear and loving son John. Your good friend, schoolmaster Pat McNamara, so good as to write these words down. Your brothers have all gone to find work in England. The house is so empty and sad. Crop of potatoes is sorely infected. A third to a half of them bad. And your sister Bridget and Patrick O'Donnell are going to be married in June. Your mother says not to work on the railroad and be sure to come on home soon. Kilkelly, Ireland, 18 and 70, my dear and loving son John. Hello to your missus and to your poor children. May they grow healthy and strong. Michael has got in a wee bit of trouble, I suppose, that he never will learn. Because of the dampness, there's no turf to speak of, and now we have nothing to burn. Bridget is happy, you named a child for her, although she's got six of her own. You say you found work, but you don't say what kind, or when you'll be coming home. Ireland, 1880, dear Michael and John, my son. I'm sorry to give you the very sad news that your dear old mother has gone. We buried her down at the church in Kilkelly. Your brothers and Bridget were there. She died very quickly. Remember her in your prayers. And it's so good to hear that Michael's returning with money he's sure to buy land. For the crop has been poor and the people are selling at any price that they can. My dear and loving son John, I suppose that I must be close on 80. It's 30 years since you've gone. Because of all of the money you spent me, I'm still living out of my home. Michael has built himself a fine house, and Bridget's daughters are grown. Thank you for sending your family picture. They're lovely young women and men. You say that you might even come for a visit. What joy to see you again. Ireland, 1892, my dear brother John. I'm sorry I didn't write sooner to tell you that father passed on. He was living with Bridget, she's best news, cheerful and healthy right down to the end. You should have seen him playing with the grandchildren at McNamara, your friend. And we buried him alongside of Mother down at the Kilkelly churchyard. He was a strong and a feisty old man, considering his life so. And it's funny the way he kept talking about you. He called for you at the end. Oh, why don't you think about coming to visit? We'd all love to see you again.
We're We're coming towards the end of the programme. I'm Dr. Miriam Knighton Gray, and I'd like to thank you for listening to This Irish American Life, coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radio hour. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to our website at www.nyuirish.net/radio hour. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Remember that next week we will be back, same time, same place. We are always very happy to have you here on This Irish American Life. And thank you for being with us for another week. Slán agus beannacht. Our theme music today is the opening set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassland and Real World Records. And this broadcast of Irish Radio Hour from Luxman Ireland House, NYU, was paid for by Luxman Ireland House, NYU, in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited.